This episode of the Vision Board Podcast is brought to you by Onnit. Why Onnit, you ask? Well, here's a word from Onnit's founder and CEO, Aubrey Marcus.
You know, Onnit is a company that has the tools to improve your performance. And in whatever area that you're looking for, we have something to do it. You know, it's like going to it's the Home Depot of house repair, but instead of house repair, it's body and mind repair. You know, and it's body and mind performance enhancement. It's going to that body shop and figuring out what tools that you can apply to help make your life better.
At the Vision Board Podcast, we only promote supplements that we use ourselves, and we only use the best. To give you insights, here's Johnny.
Yeah, guys, my two favorite that I take, one, Alpha Brain. Alpha Brain really helps improve mental focus and memory, and the second one I really swear by is Shroom Tech. Shroom Tech is designed to help your body with energy and cardiovascular endurance. What's your favorite, Tristan?
Johnny, the two that I love is the Warrior Buffalo Bars. I find these delicious snacks, and they're also perfect for when I'm on the road and also on the run. Also, I love the Dolce Whey. They're grass-fed whey protein isolate, perfect for my smoothies and also my post-workout shakes. Now, guys, check out the range at www.onnit.com, and please use code word VISIONBOARD for 10% off at checkout. Now, guys, enjoy the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Welcome back, guys. Episode 90 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
Yeah, guys, thanks for the intro, Tristan. With us today, we got Tim Kennedy. Tim has a wide array of prefixes before his name, Tristan Cannell. Talk a little bit about this guy.
Man, this dude's a savage, bro. He's a UFC fighter, if that's not enough. He's a commando. He's in the Special Forces of the Army. He's got a new show about finding Hitler on the History Channel. He does a lot of TV, a lot of media, and the guy is jacked.
Yeah, man, this guy is probably one of the most, if the world's coming to an end, you want Tim Kennedy in your corner. This guy not only is a specialist in hand-to-hand combat, mixed martial arts, the UFC, he's also a trained assassin, a sniper, special ops. This man is in charge of a lot of people, organizing the safety and the well-being of many, many, you know, American citizens with the people that he protects.
Yeah, I'm sure he's going to have some stories. You know, he's been down on the ground and in the Middle East, plus, you know, he serves back home, but, you know, it's just going to be interesting just to find out how he fits everything in terms of, like, you know, some people just a UFC fighter alone. Because
yeah,
the time commitment, training twice a day and things like that. And he's got a young family as well, so hats off to him that he wants to keep achieving. He's just started on his entrepreneurial path as well. He's launched a couple of businesses. I think he's got a menswear sort of clothing line as well happening, so the guy's busy, and I love kind of surrounding myself with guys that keep themselves busy and continually push that, you know, that boundary, you know what I mean?
Speaking of pushing boundaries, you and I are definitely going to be out of our comfort zone when we bring Tim on, man. Like you said, Tim has been in the shit. He's not only – he doesn't just have that name Special Ops. He's lived and breathed and fought and fired, aimed at people. So we're really going to touch base on some touchy subjects about what goes on during war, his opinions on this and that. I'm really interested in seeing that headspace and mindset, guys, because what we see from TV, you know, we get these little 1-2 minute glimpses of these fighters, and we really don't get the opportunity to see the guy behind the guy, unpeel that onion. So I'm really interested to see his headspace, his framework, the energy that he brings to this, and get a good look at who the real Tim Kennedy is.
Yeah, it's going to get, you know, guys, just to give you a bit of a warning, so if you don't really like things about war or fighting like that, just to give you a heads up, we will be asking Tim a few questions about his experiences in the Middle East. So if that's something you don't want to hear about, it's probably your opportunity to opt out now instead of hearing it. Like, I'm not sure how graphic he's going to go into, but it's just a little warning that just in case you do find that sort of content offensive, it's your choice to kind of opt off now.
The compelling thing about Mr. Kennedy also is, at least where I come from in America, is when the military reaches out to you, they usually see the military going to low-income neighborhoods and inner-city kids, offering them a way out. Tim, that's not his story. He's from Central California. I know that, you know, he's educated. He speaks extremely well. The guy is classically trained, you know, other than fighting. He's an artist in other senses. That's what these fighters are. So if you ever live behind the, you know, the premise of putting a stereotype on someone's title, this interview is definitely going to change your mind on that for sure. When we start getting into these interesting topics and, you know, hearing his opinion on stuff.
Yeah, and we talk about bringing value for you guys each week. You know, what's better than getting insights into someone that has to be as disciplined?
Yeah, we didn't even.
And when you think about kind of, you know, the day-to-day routines and just the little things that make up Tim Kennedy, I'm pumped for this episode, man.
He's standing shoulder to shoulder also with the likes legendary greats like George St. Pierre, former champion. Most people call him the best MMA fighter of all time. Basically starting rallying together with these fighters prolonged in their career of forming the Mixed Martial Arts Athletic Association. We'll figure that acronym once we bring him on. But what they're trying to achieve with this movement is formulate a union for the fighters, because right now the UFC, the largest mixed martial arts organization in the world, really doesn't have anything in place for these guys once they retire, maybe once they get injured. The risk is super high for these guys. So Tim is shoulder to shoulder on the front line working on formulating basically a fallback on for when these guys retire.
Yeah, and we talk about his actual ability fighting. You know, this guy smoked both Michael Bisping
and Robbie.
And Robbie Lawler.
Robbie was a champ. Michael is a champ.
Yeah.
Do you remember? So Tristan and I guys trained down in On It, and Tim was training at the same time. We didn't train with him. But I remember when we're doing a little bit of a bodyweight routine, I look out of my peripheral, and Kennedy's down there, savage that he is, no shirt on. And I just think to myself, I'm like, this dude fights at middleweight?
Yeah,
what the hell?
He's crazy big. What is he, 230 or something?
He walks around. He has to walk around at least to 220, and he cuts down to 185.
That's crazy.
So we were training with him when he wasn't. He was walking around. He was huge. Yeah, different type of dude. Really stoked to bring Tim Kennedy on, get his feedback, and inspire the hell out of you guys.
Definitely, guys. So let's get to it. Here's Tim Kennedy. All right, our special guest is Tim Kennedy. Tim is a sergeant first class with the 7th Special Forces Group with the U.S. Army. He's a UFC fighter with notable wins over current middleweight champion Michael Bisping and also former middleweight champ Robbie Lawler. Robbie Lawler. He also finds the time to star in the hit show on the History Channel, Hunting Hitler. We welcome Tim Kennedy. Tim, welcome to the show, my man.
Guys.
Tim, man, thanks for spending time with us. Like Tristan aforementioned, a lot of titles. You're always doing stuff. Fighter, soldier, host. What's up for 2017, man? Are you going to put more energy towards the show, towards fighting, towards your career? What's going on? Could you share some insight with your fans down here in Australia?
So I'm pumped for 2017. I did a lot last year, but this coming year, I think I'm going to put a lot more energy into righting wrongs, justice, you know, the things I love and care about. Obviously, I'm part of the Mixed Martial Arts Athletes Association. I'm going to be spending a lot of time with them. Definitely going to be spending more time looking for evasive little bastards like Hitler. Obviously, he's dead, so I metaphorically, you know, speaking. I'm going to do some more military stuff, so I'll be in Africa and the Middle East again. And as an entrepreneur, you know, I got 3 companies that had a great year in 2016. Woobies, which is a shoe company, Ranger Up, an apparel company, and then Sheepdog Response, which is a defensive tactics company. And I will, I'm going to hopefully be a better business partner with them and be able to help those companies grow this year a lot more.
Okay, yeah, let's focus on for this one, this first question. Could you share with us the MMA, Mixed Martial Arts Athletic Association? Is this the first of its kind? And whether it's not the first, what is your intent with this? What's your vision for this this movement?
I think it is the first of its kind. You know, all the other ones have never been an association with the sole purpose of helping the fighters. This, by design, is strategically organized to do nothing but help the fighters. This isn't a class action lawsuit. This isn't an effort to line the pockets of a bunch of lawyers. This is a mission to increase compensation for the fighters and provide pension and medical for guys that are getting their brains beat in every single day.
Awesome. Is that, now that you're not fighting as regularly, are you going to continue to fight into 2017 as well?
Man, I don't know. You know, UFC 205 against Rashad Evans at Madison Square Gardens, which is why I came back to the sport, and I was pumped for that.
Yeah.
And I was trained for that, and I peaked for that, and I was ready for that. And then this, you know, the gears and the grind of the sport absolutely destroyed me. Where they postponed the fight for another month, long fight at Madison Square Gardens, and you know, had an opponent change against, you know, a very talented, beat the brakes off of me at UFC 206. My body just straight up shut down after 4 minutes. I took a lot of wind out of my sails regarding fighting. You know, I was like, I came back for a specific event. I was ready for that event. I was ready for an opponent. And, you know, at 37, you know, a win over Rashad Evans in the biggest sports venue in the world, with Michael Bisping being the champ and having a win over him, there were title implications there.
Yeah.
Now I don't know where I stand in the division. And I love fighting. I'm always going to be a martial artist, but I don't know if I can handle dealing with, you know, if you just look at the past 4 months of what I had to, you know, put up with in the sport.
Yeah.
I still know if I, you know, I came back for something big and what I got was not fun, you know? I got almost a 4 month long fight camp fighting in Toronto, which is a great city. Love the fans there. You know, but obviously not in New York at Madison Square Gardens against a former champion. So, yeah, I don't know what I'm
going to
do.
Yeah, Tristan and I, this past June, we went down to the Onna Training Academy to do a couple interviews. And when we were training near us. And I'm 5'11". I walk around at 185. I just couldn't believe that you fight at middleweight. So the weight cut, what do you walk around at?
Well, I mean, obviously, whatever, two weeks ago, I weighed 185. Right now, I'm 220.
Jesus.
You know, the normal, natural healthy weight for me at, you know, 10% body fat is 218, 220. At UFC 205, I had peaked perfectly. My weight was perfect. You know, I stepped on the scale, weighed 185.6 or 0.8. And that was another huge problem of this prolonged fight camp. Was I had to make weight at UFC 205. So my weight shot back up to a normal, natural level immediately following, and then I had to cut again to make it to 206, to fight at 206, not to weigh 206. And that really, really, really hurt. I think that hurt my cardio. I think that hurt my strength. I think that hurt even my brain. Yeah, I'm a big guy that doesn't like cutting weight, and that's why I have to do it so strategically and perfectly. Otherwise, it ends up being catastrophic.
Tim, I just want to talk to you a little bit about nerves when you first started fighting, and then now, considering like everything that you've seen in the Middle East and things like that, do you even get nervous for fights anymore?
No. Now, if you know, you watch me walking out, even at this last fight, I was smiles. I was singing to my song "Rooster," hugging my coaches. You know, there's no anxiousness, no anxiety, no nervousness. It's just a fight. I even got beat up, you know, and that possibility is always there. I hate losing. Like, I really, 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 really hate losing. But I have no nervousness. I'm just pumped to get in there and hopefully put on a show and display some skills.
Yeah, the first two, you know, we watch a lot of the fights. The first 2-3 minutes, man, you could see you at your potential. And then as the fight went on, you know, the car, like you said, that weight cut, man. What is the feeling like when you're in that second round or third round and you know your body is telling you, Tim, you know, I got nothing, but your spirit is like, I'm never going to quit. What's that internal battle like?
It's hell. It is absolute torture. You know, like, my brain knows what's supposed to happen, but it feels like you're in sand, like you're moving in mud, like you're trying to punch in water. And, you know, it's like, I know I'm supposed to move my feet, but they're not moving how they're supposed to move. You know, it's like I'm too tough for my own good, where it's like I know I pretty horrifically tore my hamstring that first round and then the last takedown, which is about the fourth minute. And from that point on, like, I couldn't move my legs. And then the conditioning caught up with that torn hamstring, and it just got – it's almost like an existential moment where you're on the outside of the cage looking in, and you're like, oh, my God, that is a really, really, really bad version of what I'm supposed to be capable of. And then you're kind of embarrassed, and you're like, dang it, why did I do that? That's not what I'm supposed to do. Oh, my God, what am I doing now? That's not what I'm doing. That was part of the game plan. You know, and then, oh, dang, I just got punched again. And then it's just gets really depressing and sad and pathetic, humiliating.
No, man, dude, it was the thing. I think the point. Do you think there'll ever be a day in mixed martial arts where they don't put the fighter in the scenario to need to cut that much weight? I mean, if you look even at the division you're in, 185, and then the jump from 185 to 205, and then the jump from 205 to heavyweight, it's like, do you think that? To fix that, they should add more weight classes, or that set up a system. What do you think the fix is so they don't have a Tim Kennedy in there, you know, basically emaciated without any energy?
No, that had nothing to do with weight cut. That was riding a roller coaster of two different fight cards from 205 to 206, and watching my weight go from 185 to 220 to 185 back to 205. You know, if you look at whatever 20, 30 fights that I have, like, everybody recognizes me as a conditioning cardio machine. You know, you come in, and if you do it right and you do it correctly and you do it safely, you know, me even at this weight making 185, as long as I do it right, it's perfect. And I can go for 25 minutes. I can go for 35 minutes. I can go for 2 hours. You know, the body's an amazing adaptive thing, but, it had more to do with peaking at one point for a specific date at UFC 205, and then taking the roller coaster weight ride of post weigh-ins to another weigh-in 3.5 weeks later. What I'm saying is, it has less to do with and actually having to make weight than it has to do with, you know, having a date change so that you can't do it the right way.
Tim, I'm intrigued in your why behind why you're a fighter in the UFC, and also your why of why you serve your country so well.
I fight because I enjoy it. I like the challenge of seeing how far you can push yourself, you know, physically. The why of why I serve my country is because it's one of the few things I'm good at. You know, I really wish I could swing a baseball bat like Mark McGwire or Sammy Sosa, you know, without steroids. I really wish I could swing a golf club like Tiger Woods in his prime. That's not what I do well. You know, you hand me a long rifle and I can shoot something a mile away. You know, when a bomb goes off and people are screaming, I'm the calmest person in the room. You know, it's what God made me for. I'm not saying I'm happy about that, but you want to do what you're good at. And I unfortunately found what I'm good at. You know, I could list 1,000 things that I wish I was good at that I'm not. This is what I'm good at.
If you had to choose one word, what would you call that?
Damned.
Can you take us back to the origin story of you joining the army?
Oh, that's a depressing one. No, it's I was living in San Luis Obispo, California. I was in grad school, and I was a dirtbag. I was a selfish little prick. And 9/11 happened, and I had a moment where I got a glimpse at my life, and I realized that I didn't deserve to breathe the same air as, you know, people like my dad and my brother and my uncles that had, you know, all done and had contributed to such selfless levels. And then there's me. And so I had to do, I felt that I needed to do something, maybe for the first time in my life, that wasn't about me. And so I enlisted. And they fixed me just fine.
Tim, if you could go back, what type of advice would you give that younger version of yourself?
Stop being such a little asshole. Wear a condom. I don't know. I can't even. The list of things that I would go back and tell a 22-year-old version of myself, it would be humiliating and embarrassing. I don't want to share it over this call.
Yeah.
What was the process like joining the army and then obviously being in the special forces? Obviously, you had to be very, very talented, and they saw something in you to actually put you in that, into that group. What was that process?
Being too stupid to quit, too dumb to know and recognize what pain felt like. After Special Forces selection, you know, it's just the ride. You know, you go to Special Forces selection, it's 21 days of them trying to make you quit. If you don't quit and you kind of make it through all of the different gates, they say, all right, well, you can go to training. And training lasts, so once you get selected, you go to the Special Forces Q course. And the Q course takes about 14 to 18 months. And then when you graduate from that, you get your Green Beret. And then you go to your team. And then when you get to your team, they tell you that you know nothing and that everything that you've learned was a complete waste of your time, and they will then show you the things that you need to know to be a contributing member of the team, so you're not the weakest link. You know, they kind of vote you off the island if you're the weakest link, and that voting process is pretty painful, so you don't want to be that guy. I just fell in love with it. I loved the process. I loved being in the moment. I loved... you know, embracing the suck. I love the pain. All the things that, you know, break people ended up being the things that I loved. I loved being in SEER school. I loved getting beat up. I loved being in Ranger school and being frozen. I loved, you know, being in small unit tactics training and having my guerrilla G chief tell me that he was going to kill all of my guys because I didn't do what he wanted. You know, it's like, I liked all that. It was a game of chess that, you know, involved complete and utter failure, and maybe even ending up in Korea working, you know, on the worst unit. If you don't get selected, if you don't pass, you're at the needs of the army. So, you know, the stakes were high.
Tim, one of my roommates is a UFC strawweight, and she talks a lot about how intrusive the USADA process can be with drug testing them and her. Is the story true about, could you share with us the story about you greeting somebody at your doorstep at night? Is this story true?
There's a couple of stories regarding me and USADA. One is the same day that ISIS had made some pretty specific threats to me, and the FBI came and said, hey, they're trying to kill you. A USADA guy showed up, and I had a gun. I wasn't thrilled about some dude I didn't know following me into my driveway. So we had a moment of him sticking his hands out the car window and saying, I'm with you, USADA. I just need your urine.
Oh, my God.
Jesus.
Yeah. And then another one, which is a little bit more intrusive, was a guy came over after my workout. And he needed, after you work out, they can't take blood for an hour. So I just got done working out, and I said, hey, man, I need a shower. He's like, well, now that I've, you know, as an inspector, I'm here. I have to keep eyes on you. I was like, well, I'm taking a shower, so you can come on with me. That's what he did. So he joined me in the bathroom and watched me shower, which was maybe awkward for some people, but not me. Ranger school, you have like 50 guys naked next to you. This was, I guess, a little bit more normal for me than most everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Tim, talk. I'm intrigued. Just, you know, with your military stuff, what was your first impression of the Middle East when you first got there?
I love it. I love the culture. I love the people. I love the complexity of the society. I like how they treat like they just do things so much differently. It's a slower life. Like I said, I grew up in the Central Coast. You know, it's rural, and we talk things out sometimes. Sometimes you if you have a problem with somebody, you go figure it out the old school way in the backyard, you know. Cell phones aren't, you know, you don't see kids sitting in a Starbucks on the phone. They're sitting around a table drinking some really strong coffee, talking about things.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a completely different life. And, you know, yeah, there's highs and lows to it. Obviously, I have a huge problem with radical, fanatic religion. But if you took that out, if you took those crazies, that 18% of the society there out, it would be a beautiful, amazing, fantastic culture. But unfortunately, you got that 20% that's kind of hanging in there, and they're ruining it for everybody.
To switch gears towards, finding Hitler, are you familiar with General Robert Byrd? Byrd was a general in the 1940s, and he put together a team. Basically, his conspiracy theory was that it's called the Hollow Earth theory. Have you heard of this?
Yes.
With he felt like Hitler wasn't killed, and that he was able to. You could find, guys, listen. You guys could find this on the internet. Just Google it. It's called the Hollow Earth theory. But Hitler is there's an area of the North Pole that you can't fly over. It's a no-fly zone, and he believed that you could fly down into this, and that Hitler brought his Aryan race, 7-foot blonde hair, blue eye Aryan race down there with extreme technology, evolved society. Have you touched base on that at all?
We're familiar with it. Obviously, our efforts in hunting Hitler have been to the best of our ability to go down the most logical and rational possibilities. I'm not saying that that's not a possibility, but a special forces guy, and with Lenny DePaul and Gerard Williams and Mike Simpson and the rest of the team, when we sat there and looked at the evidence that we had and what we would do if we were going to try to get Hitler out of there, we've been investigating every one of those options. As the seasons continue to roll out, doing a third season, we have 3 more episodes, and people love this show. Yeah. It's compelling, the historical implications and maybe the ramifications of what it would mean if one of the most evil dudes of the human race survived and lived to old age after being lied, about what happened to him, was lied about by, all of the allies. It's frightening.
Yeah. Given your experience and what you're going through now, seriously, what do you think actually did happen to him?
What I know is that history is wrong. That history was inaccurate and history is incomplete. It is not fair and it's not accurate to say on this date Hitler, committed suicide with his then wife Eva. That's not true. I'm not saying he made it out of that bunker and got on a plane and flew to Argentina, but there's not enough evidence to say that that's what's happened. There's not a single witness that can collaborate that isn't disagreed with by any other witnesses. If you have everybody that was in the bunker pretty much disagrees about what happened. And then the forensic evidence that we got from there is so inconclusive. The skull that's supposedly Hitler's that the Russians have had and for the past 80 years is we got Hitler's skull. Ends up being a middle-aged woman. So unless there's a sex change, you know, in his early 20s. And then he pretended to be a dude with a fantastic mustache for the rest of his life. They had the wrong body. So now we have the Russians that are recovering the wrong body with a whole bunch of stories that don't line up. So, you know, hell, I have no idea what happened.
Yeah, do you guys ever touch base on, part of my ignorance for not watching every episode, but the type of impact he had, his speaking style, how people just listened and followed him. Are there any parallels with the good side of comparing him to, like, what if he would have done good sort of thing, he would have been, like, this type of leader? Do people do that? Do you guys ever chat about that?
Well, yeah, we absolutely chat about it. You know, the problem is there's just not enough time. Hmm. You know, we could do 50 seasons on this. You know, he got into the cult. He was obsessed with, you know, the spirit of death. And religion and, you know, super weapons and nuclear weapons and heavy water and, you know, like, that guy, he got us to the moon. You know, Hitler and his scientists made America the first country to step foot on the moon, you know, and to build the first nuclear bomb and to essentially win World War II by way of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that man, as insane and horrible and violent and disgusting as he's brilliant, you know, and he was charismatic, and he could connect and unite a country in a way that we have never maybe seen in history. Had that energy been directed towards good, it's unimaginable what contributions he could have made. You know, like, maybe we wouldn't even have cancer now. You know, if the scientists that he had, instead of, you know, Mandalay, trying, you know, the angel of death trying to do these abomination tests on twins in Auschwitz, he used that brilliant mind of his to cure cancer. Instead of trying to build the atom bomb, they worked on limitless energy, and now we have free power for the entire world on how to purify water or how to, you know, take trash and build a transport tube like in Star Trek, and then we could get rid of cars and fossil fuels and just transport our goods and our needs, and even humans maybe. Like, there's no telling what could have happened. Instead, he killed somewhere between 7 and 11 million people because he didn't like the way that they looked or they sounded or their ethnic heritage or their religion or their eye color, you know. Yeah, it's just madness.
It reminds me, there's a podcast I listened to recently about Genghis Khan, and you said that there's just not enough time, and maybe there's a relation to what they meant with Khan, because it's been over like 1,000 years or whatever, and he was responsible for so many deaths, but also births, and now in hindsight, he was responsible for connecting parts of the world that had never been connected, and that sort of thing. So do you think that maybe in 100, 200 years from now, they'll start outlying, or maybe positives that Hitler threw negatives will start being on the surface, that sort of thing? And are there any that you could see, maybe? Like, shit, he's done obviously the most evil things with his actions, but the scientists, right? Like, after it all came to an end, wasn't there a guy, like you said, responsible for going to the moon? Didn't those scientists, those high-level guys, come to America? Wasn't the bomb, Einstein, everything? Were those guys working for him?
Yeah, they're all German.
That's gnarly. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, even one of the prevalent theories about him, his escape, is the reason that we got all of the German scientists instead of the Russians, because the Russians could have had them just as easily as we could have, was we facilitated his escape. And in exchange for his scientists, because we knew that as soon as World War II ended, we would be looking communism and the Red Bear in the face. So, you know, towards after Stalingrad, you know, from 44 on, we knew that we were going to win that war, as did the Germans, as did the Russians. So our focus went from, you know, the possibility of, you know, everybody speaking German, every Jew on the planet dying, to, all right, the next fight is communism. And what is that going to look like? So we then took all of the scientists and all of their brilliant minds of engineering, and in exchange, we let Hitler walk. Hmm. Scary, but very possible.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Yeah. With kind of all these talk about different traits, just yourself with your own personal experience with different commanders and things like that in the Army, what good leadership traits do you like, or do you like to, you know, now that you're an entrepreneur as well, you like to use every day?
Understand what delegation means. And so in the military, being able to have somebody do something in your ability to delegate that, you know, so that you don't take on more than you can handle is vital. But for you to be able to delegate, you have to be working harder than everybody. For me to say, hey, will you do this? It's not, will you do this so I don't have to? It's, will you do this so I can do more? And, you know, I think that's missed a lot. You know, I want to be the first person off the helicopter, the last person on the helicopter. I want to be the guy that's, you know, gets dirty first. I want to be the guy that's trying to be, work smarter and harder than everybody else. And as a leader, and you know, in now as an entrepreneur and a business owner, it's not only do I want to do all that, you know, be working harder, be working smarter, be working more economically, be working more efficiently, it's also being able to lead and delegate so that, you know, people see that and respect me and then want to in turn work just as hard as I am, you know. And so then when I ask them to do something, I'm not telling them to do it. I shouldn't need to. It's finding those, you know, those other leaders that you can inspire to work hard for you.
What do you feel? What do you, you know, what's your reason for, like, you have such conviction, persistence, drive, motivation? What is the origin of all of that? Is that something that's always been within you as a young boy? Was this something that, you know, what is light fueling that fire?
I think I've always been this way. It's definitely developed and I've got more passion about it. You know, like if at this point if I wasn't part of something bigger and greater than myself and I wasn't contributing to something that was more meaningful than just who I am, then everything that I've done, all, you know, from the people that I've killed and that, and you know, the hell, the villages I've burnt, you know, it'd be for nothing. It would be madness. And, you know, it would drive me insane. I would be a crazy person if I looked back and I was like, oh my God, I've done all of these things for, you know, for myself or for, because I enjoyed it or any other horrible, horrific realization besides I'm doing it for, because it's right. And it's, you know, part of the greater good. And, you know, it's because I believe in freedom and, or that, you know, like a girl should be able to go to school and not have acid thrown in her face, and she shouldn't be sold, and you know, you shouldn't be able to be forcing people to be work in your opium fields so that you can then sell it in Pakistan. You know, like if I wasn't contributing to humanity, to, you know, the human condition, to mankind, man, I would be insane. I'd just flat out be a crazy person.
Yeah, my brother-in-law is a lieutenant in the Air Force. My two best friends are in the Marine Corps. When I asked you earlier about one word about yourself, you said damned. I think I would say protector, man. So we appreciate all that you do.
I love it, honestly.
Tim, just a segue off that, I know you do a lot of charity work with the Sheepdog Survival Fund. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So I have a company, a defensive tactics company called Sheepdog Response. And, you know, we teach law enforcement, military, and some civilians about how to be the hardest person somebody ever tries to kill. You know, emergency medicine, if you have the responsibility to take a life, you know, like a like a police officer does, you should also have the capability to save a life. So what we realized within the first few months of running this company is that there's this vast, deep void of what police officers and law enforcement need to know and the amount of training that they receive. There's not enough money, there's not enough time, and there's not, and ultimately they don't even have the right equipment to be able to do it. So we started the Sheepdog Survival Fund, which provides training and equipment to law enforcement and military and first responders to get the training and the tools that they need to do their job. You know, the United States, we've had, especially 2016 shootings that didn't need to happen. You know, police officers trying to do the right thing, but they couldn't or didn't because, you know, maybe they needed more training or they needed more tools or, you know, there was something that was missing. And because of that, somebody died. That's not the right answer. You know, this can be fixed. So that's what we, that's our mission, is to make sure that every police officer gets the training that they need to do their jobs. Every military soldier that's about to step overseas, they have the right equipment. You know, that they have tourniquets, that they have the right magazines, that they have the right optics. I know what that stuff is. You know, like, I still work. You know, I'm still in Africa. I'm still in the Middle East. I'm still going to South America. You know, I'm still here in the United States doing real work. And you know, no one is going to know what that stuff is better than myself and or the people that I'm training at the highest level. So with that information, we identify voids and then we try to fill them as best as we can.
Yeah, we were chatting with Dan Severn a while back, and he was sharing with us the work that he does with law enforcement, I think the FBI, with, you know, hand-to-hand combat. He has the thing where he helps those guys out. With this this movement of yours, are you doing that as well, other than the tactics, like the fighting style?
Yeah, absolutely. We are getting police officers, without a doubt, the best prepared Oh, man, hey, can you hold on 2 seconds?
Yeah, of course.
Hey, Kate, did Nick pull out those presents? Awesome. Okay, sorry, I'm back.
Yeah, mate.
Yeah, so we do all defensive tactics, from how to cuff somebody, how to restrain somebody, you know, to situational awareness, biometrics. I have a staff of like 25 instructors now, that from Ranger Battalion, Navy SEALs, obviously some Army Rangers, some Green Berets, a bunch of black belts in jiu-jitsu, former law enforcement, firefighters, doctors, like the staff that we have in this company is unmatched. There's nobody in the world that knows this stuff better than us. Unfortunately, we have to start, you know, especially with military and law enforcement firefighters, we have to start at a very fundamental level. Like, here's how you do a takedown. Here is a double leg. Here is a single leg. Here is mount. Here is side control. Here's the guard. Here's how you pass the guard. Here's rear mount. You know, there's a lot of rules about what they're allowed to do, you know, from how to restrain somebody. So depending on what department they are or what unit they're in, we are very limited as to what we can show them. I wish they could know everything, and then they could, one, keep themselves safe, and then they could choose what is the best thing. But we got a lot of work. You know, Sheepdog Response is only 1 year old, and, you know, we are looking to hire more guys. We have more work than we can handle, and fortunately, the Survival Fund is stepping up to help different departments. You know, even the next week, I'm here in California. I'm going to be going up to Monterey County Sheriff's Department, and I'll be working with their defensive tactics instructor and bringing in a lot of the SWAT, EOD, the deputies that really have the highest risk, and doing some basic defensive tactics stuff for them. You know, and that's all pro bono, you know, because the department doesn't have the money even to spend on the stuff that these guys need.
Are you a naturally organized person? Because you seem to be wearing so many different hats and doing it so well. Is that something that just comes naturally to you?
No, I don't think anybody's born organized. It's something you have to work at, and you have to be disciplined about, and then you have to ultimately figure out how to be the most efficient version of yourself, and that is not an easy thing.
Yeah. Another thing I noticed the other day, you put a video up on your Facebook, and you had a big bookshelf behind you. I was always interested in what people were reading and something that they might be able to share with our audience.
I read everything. I have a brain that is hard to shut off. So at night and on planes, I'm not that guy that's sitting there playing video games. You know, let's download the new War of World apps.
So you don't play Call of Duty.
No, there was like a year or two where I did.
You'd kill it.
I realized how much time I wasted. It was just a way for me to like check out, but I'm so much more efficient. Yeah, so on the plane, laptop's open, I'm listening to music, I'm jamming, I'm working. Laptop closes, out comes a book. I switch out. I bounce between fiction, non-fiction, every other book. So I'll read like, a historical something or a biography, and then I'll switch to something fun that challenges, even my perception of something, because it's fantasy or it's sci-fi or it's something beautiful and creative, or sometimes dark and horrible, whatever it is, it's just outside of that realm. And then boom, right back to a biography or something boring sometimes.
Actually, a funny question. Okay, so you're a ranger, you're a sniper. Are you even good at Call of Duty?
Am I what about Call of Duty?
Are you good?
Am I good?
Or do you find it frustrating that it's not the same, it's not the real life?
Oh God, I hope they never are able to recreate what war is actually like. Yeah. That would be horrible.
I'm sure that when you're holding a gun, it's quite easy for you to actually use it. For them to actually try and create it in real life, do you find that like that difficult?
I enjoyed playing Call of Duty. I was decent at it. Obviously, there's an 11-year-old kid in a basement that would crush me effortlessly. it was fun. It's nothing like real life, obviously, thankfully. I saw a reality thing once where they took some video game kids and they actually put the kit on them and let them go try to, move around the block once. It's like once you put my body armor on, you put my grenades on and my ammo on, and you're wearing, maybe the groin protector flak drop down with your helmet, with your nods. Maybe you have a thermal imager, depending on what guns you're carrying, from a pistol, shotgun, breaching shotgun, long rifle, carbine. Maybe 120 pounds of gear. The guys could make it around the block, and nobody was shooting at them. They're just trying to make it around the block. So it's kind of fun knowing that, oh, this is so much fun. I can run down the street with this gigantic machine gun, like a 50 cal, and just jump on the ground and shoot. It's fun. Thank God it doesn't feel like real life, where you're hands bleeding and you got dirt in your eye and you just watch your best friend's head get canoed and you think you're about to die, and then you roll over and this dude that's just got shot next to you, he just crapped himself and he's covered in his cerebral spinal fluid. You're like, yeah, don't want that recreated. That'd be a pretty horrific experience.
Tim, you've been brilliant. Thank you for all your insights. I've got a couple personality questions just to finish. Now, the first one is going to take you back more towards your childhood, towards how you were growing up. Now, Tim Kennedy, what posters were on your wall growing up, my man?
It came from a classic educational background. We had season tickets to the Davies Hall in San Francisco, which is what the San Francisco Symphony plays. So we had like Starry Nights hanging up on the wall. We had Monets, we had Renoirs. There were no posters, they were prints of the master's work. I played the piano growing up, so sometimes there were changing on depending on what thing we were getting ready for. We had different pieces of music that were sometimes hung, but that was up on my walls.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah,
we just had Aubrey Marcus on about an hour ago, and he had Playboy models on his wall. So that's quite insightful, and I actually like your one better, to be honest.
Tim, have you seen the movie Empire of the Sun?
I have.
What do you think of it?
Loved it.
Me too. Okay, good. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's like, I think Spielberg did it. On just want to throw that out there. You brought up the music, and I think that film was, you know, they had that song playing. I was so obsessed with that song when Christian Bale is a boy singing it. It's called Suo Gan. It's the Japanese. I think it might be their country song, their anthem. But, you know, I was going to ask you your opinion on, like, movies such as that, but I'm going to turn the page a little bit because I want to end it on a positive note. A question we ask, it's a dinner party question. Tim, you get to invite 5 people to dinner. They could be anyone dead or alive, but they can't be any family or friends. Who is Tim Kennedy inviting to dinner?
George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Hitler.
I was about to say that. Would you invite Hitler?
Yeah, I would. Genghis Khan and Hannibal.
And where could your fans listening and our fans continue to follow you and support your journey online?
Tim Kennedy MMA is everything. Snapchat's Tim Kennedy MMA. Instagram's Tim Kennedy MMA. You know, Facebook, Twitter. I think I have them all. So everything's Tim Kennedy MMA. And appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
That was Tim Kennedy, guys. We hope you really enjoyed this episode.
Guys, if you really enjoyed that episode, the best thing you could do for us is tell your family and friends. You know, share it for us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. That really just helps us grow. And we'll continue to bring all these inspiring stories from around the world.
Definitely. We really appreciate the love and support. Like our Facebook page, The Vision Board Podcast. Support the cause. I know a lot of our American fans. Twitter is huge there. Follow us on Twitter, The Vision Board Podcast. Johnny Stofko, Tristan Cannell on all other social media platforms.
Definitely, guys. And on next, we've got Onnit CEO Aubrey Marcus. So that will be on Wednesday, followed by our new wrap-up show, which will be on Friday. So on a Friday, we'll be wrapping up the two episodes that we do during the week, and also just talking about different things that we think that can bring you a little bit of value as well.
Super excited for that. I know you guys are as well. Also, to stay in the loop, if you haven't already, be sure to go to our website, thevisionboardpodcast.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Definitely, guys. Nice and easy. So, like Johnny said, just straight on the website, and you also get a free copy of the ebook. Johnny, another great episode, and I'll see you Wednesday for Aubrey, my man.
Excellent. Aubrey Marcus, ladies and gentlemen.
Can't wait.
Peace.
See you guys soon. Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are 2 for 2.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.